The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Okay, how to start. We moved on a bright day in June. Not exactly gripping. It was the move that started it all. Too generic.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's hard to calculate accurately, but here goes. Each year, some 1 million books are published in the U.S. That's give or take a few hundred thousand. And that number grows each year as more and more people turn to self-publishing to follow their dreams of becoming an author, which is crazy ambitious when you think about just what an impassioned, disciplined, even Herculean task it is to write, publish, and promote a book. Today, we're celebrating that effort with a show devoted to the formidable, crazy-making process of becoming an author. We'll hear about how books are brought from imaginative spark to pitching an agent or publisher to getting a blurb on the back cover, with lots of advice from people who've made it happen in between. And we're doing it all in book form, so...
Word of Mouth presents Bookish. An audio program in 9 chapters, hosted by Virginia Prescott, with narration by Catherine Kellgren. Chapter 1, Prompt and Circumstance.
So you want to write a book, or maybe a memoir, but you are staring at a blank page, wondering where to begin. One way to get the juices flowing, a prompt. Lee Seligman teaches at Keene State College and is author of A Pocketbook of Prompts. And yes, we field tested it, and it is pocket-sized.
So it fits in your front shirt pocket or your back pocket or your breeches or your handbag or your backpack or whatever. And it's neat because then you can go anywhere. So if I'm out in the woods walking my dog, fun to have prompts. Or it's super great when you're standing in a queue somewhere.
Leaf has been collecting these prompts for years. She regards writing as a way to stir reflection and better understand the self. But a good prompt can also turn into something greater, a poem, a memoir, maybe even a novel. This chapter with Leif Seligman was produced by Taylor Quimby.
What is one significant flaw you have? If you could change it, would you want to? Writing prompts give us a place to start. They're sort of like, I don't know, the toenails on my dog. You know, they give you traction. You're looking at the blank page going, where do I go? What do I do? Oh my gosh, it's overwhelming. And then you just have a prompt and it gives you a little grip. And then, like the dog, you can wander off in the woods. You can certainly leave the trail that the prompt might indicate that you're going to follow, but that's fine because that's its purpose. Its purpose is just to get you going. If you could choose the very last things you would see, hear, feel, taste, and smell before you die, what would they be and why? I think a good prompt needs to be open-ended and not too deliberate. So for instance, I have a question that says, if you could have a banquet of forgiveness, you know, who would you invite to it? Well, obviously a banquet of forgiveness is a metaphor, but banquet was just the right word because there's a kind of lushness, there's an abundance to a banquet. If for someone who's really attentive to every word, each word can be a doorway. And for someone who's less attentive to every word, but just goes right to sort of the heart of it and says, oh, okay, this is something about forgiveness, it's still useful. So I would say the most helpful prompts are the ones that have multi-layers. If you could go back in time, to what year, decade, or era would you go? Where would you go? What would you do? What intrigues you about that time?
Do you have a favorite? I mean, that's a hard thing.
Do I have a favorite prompt?
Yeah, actually
I do.
Oh, what is it?
Oh, my favorite prompt is to write your life story in 5 lines.
Ooh.
And I think the reason the 5-line autobiography is my favorite prompt is because, one, it really invites a person to get to the essential matter of who are you and what matters to you. And also it changes. So I do that prompt over and over and over again. And over the literally probably 25 or 30 years that I've been playing with that prompt, my answers have really changed. And also it's a prompt that elicits from other people a kind of like gasp, like, what? How can I begin to tell my life story in 5 lines? That's impossible. And I think, will write, but it's about experiencing how you can find freedom in constraint. That if you only have five lines and you're constrained by that economy of prose, it really does force, it frees you to get rid of everything extraneous.
That was Liev Seligman, author of A Pocket Book of Prompts, speaking with our producer, Taylor Quimby.
Chapter 2, Pitch and Prejudice.
Maybe coming up with an idea isn't your challenge. Maybe you've had the plot for a novel or thesis for a nonfiction book or a memoir floating around in your head for years. Maybe you have a first draft already finished. Now for the most intimidating part, pitching your idea to an agent or a publisher. Well, to help ease the anxiety of putting yourself out there, we asked aspiring authors to email us 150-word book pitches, and in turn, we sent them to Michelle Brower. She's a literary agent with Zachary Schuster Harmsworth and Kuhn Projects. She picked her favorite three of the bunch and joins us now to tell us what drew her in and to offer some tips on how to write an arresting pitch and what not to do. Michelle, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. I'm so happy to be here.
Michelle, what are some of the things you are looking for? What seizes you when you're looking at a book pitch?
So primarily the kind of books I work on are novels these days. And I'm always looking to sort of be swept away. To me, what makes a pitch really wonderful is it's both somewhat familiar. I can see where it would fit in the marketplace. I can imagine who the reader might be, but also different. Something that's a concept I haven't really heard before that feels really fresh and a new take on something. I always encourage people who are pitching me and other agents or publishers to include books for reference that they kind of think that their book is somewhat kin to. So the way that I like to frame that is if your book was on a reader's shelf, what are the other books that are sitting next to it?
Okay, how about some of those things one should not do when pitching your book?
There are a lot of things not to do. The first, I might say, is really not knowing the market. So having a book that's far too long, having a book that's far too short, having a book that is supposed to be a crime novel but doesn't really have that suspense element in it, telegraphing success far too much and far too quickly. You need to publish this book. This book will be bigger than Harry Potter. This book is for people ages 8 to 80. Books selling itself doesn't really work that way. You really have to, you know, when you go into a bookstore, there is not an 8 to 80 section. There's a children's section and an adult section. And so you have to think, where in this bookstore would my book go?
How about format and structure? How would you like a pitch to come to you?
I always like to see a pitch in this sort of generalized structure that really matches the back of a book copy. It starts out with the premise, what's going on sort of at the beginning of the book. Then there's usually some kind of inciting incident or conflict, something that really gets the action going. And then it sort of points us at a path to resolution. So where does this story sort of, what direction does it head? I really like to see someone who's secure in their story. And that means they don't need to pump it up with laudatory adjectives. They are just presenting it as it is. And the pitch is usually the very, very, very beginning of what would become a creative professional relationship. And so I want to get a sense from the pitch that this, in fact, is a person that I would really like to work with for a long time. And so part of that is, you know, thinking about if you were going into a job interview. You don't curse in a job interview. You don't get wacky in a job interview. You usually present your sort of best self in that way. And I like to think of a pitch as a similar kind of interaction.
How many pitches land on your desk in a given day or week?
I'd say I get about 100 to 150 per week. And so as you can see from that number, that I don't take on a lot of the pitches that come to me. However, that being said, I really am looking for something that I can fall in love with in the unsolicited submissions. And I often do find something. I would say that I sign pretty regularly 1 to 2 authors per year. So while that is a daunting percentage, it is still something I'm very actively looking at and trying to bring in.
Well, then we are extra grateful that we gave you a week's worth of work and you went through them. So tell us, what did you like in the pitches that we sent? Do you want to start with your top three?
Absolutely. So I'll take a look at the top three pitches. Now, all of these share is a distinct concept. So on the first pitch, it starts out with Mountain View Community Acres was exactly the type of assisted living facility that manager Katie Harwick felt was the right place to pull her life back together. So that there is our premise. But then we come to the conflict. It should have been a short-term job. The property is to be sold to a developer once the last resident has passed away. But 13 residents now remain, all of whom have passed the centenarian mark. As the average age rises, so do tensions. Relatives, financial pressure, the media is intrigued, and religious pilgrims believe the residents' longevity is a modern-day miracle. And it sounds like from the setup that there might be a lot of individual stories packed into this one story, but it has a defining arc that will bring it all together.
Yeah, I like this. It falls on Harwick and an overworked caseworker to listen to their tales and unravel the mystery of what is binding these souls to Earth. Sounds like there could be a lot here.
Yeah.
How about Secrets of Flight? That was your next choice.
Yeah, so Secrets of Flight. This one is about a woman who falls in love with a divorced man with a young daughter. They have a son, but their son, whose name is Robin, is having problems. So he has problems socially, and he has an obsession with classifying birds. And birds start appearing everywhere in the woman's life. It says here, flying into windows, perching on her hat, landing injured on her front doorstep. And then she finds a 100-year-old book about augury, which is the ancient art of predicting the future based on the pattern of birds flying. And then other things happen where the family is sort of unraveling. What appealed to me about this pitch is that it takes something sort of magical and unique, this idea of augury and birds and something unusual happening with the birds, and puts it in the context of a family drama. So again, when I say something that's familiar yet different, it's a family drama, yet there's this one thing about it that's very different, and that's what called out to me here.
So bravo for that pitch. And then there's one that quite a few of us liked in our pod, The Cat Who Loved the Moon.
So this is about a cat who thinks that he is very similar to the moon. He has the same shapes as the moon, which I imagine means sometimes he's round and fat and sometimes stretched out. And the moon goes everywhere that he goes. And he decides that he loves the moon. But one day the moon goes away. So this is a children's picture book. And one of the things that also jumped out at me from the pitch is it specifically says this is a non-rhyming children's picture book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually very important because it's rhyming is not in fashion these days in children's picture books and new ones. And so this shows me that the author has a sense of what's working in the marketplace because it's not your typical rhyming book, which might be something based off of what was popular 20 years ago.
Well, congratulations then to all those three for capturing your attention and imagination. Mm-hmm. Michelle, I'm thinking that everyone who submitted a book pitch to us, you know, there's a lot of hope that goes into that, a lot of heart, mm-hmm. I'm sure, and uh-huh. some courage. Any words of comfort for people whose books did not capture your imagination in that way?
Yes, I have two sort of things to say about that. One is rejection is part of being a writer. So it's not just you. And secondly, if you truly love writing, keep on with it. Even if you have been rejected, look at your novel and say, well, what's not working here? Put that novel aside and start a new one. If you really do wish to be a writer, the writing itself has to be more important than the publishing.
Do you ever recommend people to publish this yourself? You could do it.
I do sometimes. I think that in the self-publishing world, commercial fiction is the genre that works. So that's a lot of different genres that can be packed into that. But I have actually worked with authors who began by self-publishing. Again, research your market. Know who your reader is. It's just as important there as it is for a traditional publisher. But I do think that it's a very valid way to go.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for going through this with us. It's really helpful.
Thank you, Virginia. It's such a pleasure.
Michelle Brower, literary agent with Zachary Schuster Harmsworth and Kuhn Projects. She was kind enough to go through all of the fantastic pitches that you sent to us, and there were tons of great submissions. So thank you for sharing your ideas with us, and we hope that this has been helpful. Okay, when we come back, we're going to face off against a writer's worst distraction. Surprise, it's the internet.
You spend a moment on Facebook, then Instagram, then Tumblr, then Twitter, then Pinterest, then Goodreads, and before you know it, it's lunchtime and you've written 7 words.
That's when our special program, Bookish, continues.
Insert disc number 2.
To begin. How to start? I'm hungry. I should get coffee. Coffee would help me think. But I should write something first, then reward myself with coffee. Coffee and a muffin. Okay, so I need to establish the themes. Maybe banana nut. That's a good muffin.
Welcome back. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today Word of Mouth presents Bookish, an audio program in 9 chapters, where we peek behind the scrim of literary creativity and read between the lines of the publishing world. So, where were we?
Chapter 3, From Here to Eternity, on Twitter.
In addition to hosting Word of Mouth, I host a podcast called the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop and ask a variety of writers about their creative process. I pretty much ask the same questions for everybody because it is interesting to see how different writers approach their craft. Few authors approach editing the same way, for example, or they have different preferences about where to write, you know, with quiet or music or familiar objects or in cafes. But nearly every author I have spoken to for the podcast agrees on one thing. What's your worst personal distraction from getting your work done, your writing?
Oh, God, the internet. Yeah.
That's Olivia Lang. She's author of The Lonely City and The Trip to Echo Spring.
I mean, once I'm deeply in a book and I'm struggling with it, I will spend 24 hours a day online to just distract myself. I'll go online between every single word. It's amazing I write books so fast, considering how much dreadful time I waste.
Of course, this distraction plays itself out differently for different authors. So for Alexander McCall Smith, who writes the number one ladies detective agency series, among others, the most insidious time waster is email.
If you sit there and you think, well, maybe I'll just check my email, that's the road to ruin.
For others, the biggest online distraction is one that many non-writers can also relate to. Here is the YouTube star and the best-selling author, Grace Helbig.
Oh, I mean, social media is just the most difficult distraction. It's my hobby and my job all at once, and so it is so easy for me while I'm typing a chapter on a computer to just quietly open another tab and look at what people are saying on Twitter or shop at topshop.com.
Grace points out a complicated development in the literary world. Social media is not just an escape. It is a professional necessity. Chris Bajalian, author of books like Midwives and The Guest Room, agrees.
The reality is that novelists today have to be social network animals. And that's fine. I think it's a great gift that now I'm not simply a disembodied black and white author's photo in the back of the book. But it's so easy to get sucked into the vortex.
But then, those could all be very pro-social excuses for that other, more embarrassing online distraction. Here's pop culture critic and former New York Times ethicist, Chuck Klosterman, author of Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs.
I have a friend who's a writer, and he told me that the biggest distraction is that his writing machine is also his pornography delivery machine. I thought that was a really hilarious, insightful thing.
Yes. Don't we all know a friend with a problem? Of the dozens of writers that I've spoken to for the 10-Minute Writers Workshop so far, the internet and social media dominated as time wasters. In this old-school way to procrastinate that came from our very first workshop was Salman Rushdie.
What is your absolute worst distraction or easiest thing to get you off track?
Baseball.
You can hear much more about the experience of people who make their living by their creativity by subscribing to the 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcast on iTunes. Whatever it is that's keeping you from working, be it Twitter or cupcakes or the Red Sox, here's some tough love from Joe Hill, author of Nosferatu and The Fireman.
Writing is hard and it asks you to be lonely and isolated. And I think it's important to be alone and to be willing to be uncomfortable and just sit there and have that struggle to find the next good sentence and the next good sentence after that.
Good advice, but easier said than done, which gets us to our next topic.
Chapter 4, Zen and the Art of Typewriter Maintenance.
If you have a hard time staying on task, maybe you need a different set of tools. Rob Green is an author, a teacher at Nashua High School South, and chair of the New Hampshire Writers Project. He made the case to our producer, Taylor Quimby, for an old-fashioned approach to avoiding distractions.
I'm a first draft typewriter person. I like manual typewriters to bang out that first draft on for various reasons. There are basically two kinds of writers in the world. There are what they call word vomiters and there are diamond polishers. And word vomiters are the kinds who just like want to crank through the process, crank through the story, and then go back and go clean up the mess and fix it, figure it out. And I'm a vomiter myself. And I find that the typewriter is the best mechanism for vomiting because it only does one thing. It does that thing very well. It makes interesting noises. It's a very nice tactile experience. And it doesn't get Wi-Fi. I work with high school students, and I find that certain kids with like certain learning disabilities, like ADHD and things like that, they actually do better on a typewriter because it's kinesthetic. It's all mechanical, so as you're typing, everything is making a noise, and it's kind of attracting your attention. There's not a screen or anything like that, so you're actually watching and listening. I like the way they look. You know, they were designed to kind of reflect the cars of the day. So if you look at like a 1920s typewriter, it looks a lot like a Model T.
Yeah.
And if you kind of go up all the train, you know, that looks more like a 1950s kind of car. This looks more like a 1970s kind of car.
Yeah, totally.
And it kind of keeps going up that way until they became obsolete. If you ask my wife, I have 40 some odd. If you ask me, I say 30 because I don't count the ones that don't work. I've got a couple of favorite ones. I've got three that type in cursive, and I've got an SG-1, probably a 1954 SG-1. I call it the Judge because it's this big honking 45-pound typewriter. It doesn't slide all over the desk like the portables do, and I've cranked out two books on that thing in the last 2 years. So. What I brought in today for you, I brought in the one you've got closest to you. That's a, what is that? Is that a Royal or an Underwood? I can't remember anymore.
Underwood. It's like a military green. I love the color.
Yeah, so that's like a mid-1950s Underwood, which is a little brother of one that Hemingway liked to use. And the other one I've got here is Swedish. It's a Facket, and this is from the mid-70s.
Can we pop a piece of paper in and take a listen?
We can do that. You say you type fast, right?
On a keyboard, I type pretty fast, yeah.
It's like a combination of keyboarding and playing the piano, because you've got to put a little more strength into it than you might otherwise expect.
Mm. And I don't have, do I have shift?
That's shift. Yeah,
yeah, okay.
You found it as shift lock.
Oh, all right. Okay, yeah. You know what? I can feel like you have to get a bounce into your fingers.
Mm-hmm. It's very staccato. You get a push and lift, push and lift, push and lift. After they get older, you know, there are certain keys that stick and certain keys that don't stick, and this one bell rings like this and this bell rings like that, you know, and so they do develop their own kind of, it's like a car, develops its own personality, unlike a laptop that you're going to keep for like 3 years, 3 to 5 years and get rid of.
So if I want to get a typewriter, where should I look?
Before the hipsters started getting involved, you could get them at like Goodwill or Savers pretty darn cheap, you know, but now it's harder. You know, you can still get them on eBay, but they're overpriced. You know, you can get them on Etsy, but they're overpriced. There's the Goodwill stores has an auction site, shopgoodwills.com, where you can sometimes get some good deals, but those are still overpriced. so it gets harder and harder to find. I mean, I think this Facket I paid $5 for.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, so you can still find them, but you really, it's harder than it was to find them. So keep an eye on your lawn sales, you know, test them out before you bring them home. You got to be kind of bargain huntery.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Good enough.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
Good to meet you.
Good to meet you too.
Thanks for letting me come in and play.
Chapter 5. A portrait of the author as a young man.
So imagine this. The book is done, the advance is being spent. All that's left before publishing are a few design decisions and details. and one particular detail that inspires more angst than you might imagine.
I'm 39 years old. It feels weird to like obsess about a photograph. You know, it makes you feel like you're, I don't know, going to prom or something.
In 2015, Max Wirestone was getting ready to release his debut novel, The Unfortunate Decisions of Dahlia Moss, when he found himself facing what may be the most awkward part of the publishing process and its projection of the writerly brand, the author photo. Max told this story to producer Taylor Quimby.
It's sort of undignified to be spending a lot of time thinking about it, but you do, you know, like, what are you going to wear? How are you going to dress? There's a whole question of, like, makeup. I came into this as a librarian, so, I see the author photos all the time, which I feel like maybe isn't helpful. You know, you have all the cliches that you want to avoid, like touching your face or, like, looking too thoughtful or looking too hipstery. I settled on like kind of this jogging outfit, which seems really dumb in retrospect, but it felt like the most neutral thing I could come up with. So yeah, I had someone come and take my photograph. The biggest issue was like the morning of, I ended up, you know, so I'm shaving. I want to have like a nice clean shaven thing, and I just slice my face like right open. Like, I mean, not just like one slice, but it's just like raised over. It's like I have been attacked by leeches across my neck. You know, my brand is like vampire or like sort of wounded person. And I ended up went out to the mall in Concord, and I just was basically wandering like the makeup aisles of like the Bonton, and just I just come up to some like poor woman and I'm like, I don't know anything about makeup and I'm bleeding everywhere. What do I do? And so she does something to me and I look okay. And you can see on my photograph, you know, you can't tell that I'm bleeding.
So if you could do it again, would you have done it differently?
What would I do differently? I think I would just go in for, I would touch my face. I would go in for the cliches. I mean,
like maybe a smoking jacket, a pipe.
That's right. Yeah. And the other thing is, I was looking at, I've been looking at them more and more. It's like, there's some good authors that do some of the cliche things, you know, just because everyone's doing it, it's not necessarily bad. Like Roxanne is gay, is totally touching her face, you know, and I figure it's good enough for her, you know, why not me?
Max Wirestone, author of The Unfortunate Decisions of Dahlia Moss, speaking there with Taylor Quimby. Okay, so that covers the inside flap of the book jacket. Now what are you going to do on the back?
Chapter 6, To Blurb a Mockingbird.
With millions of books to choose from, readers look to others to help them decide what to read next. That's why we have book reviews and book clubs and bookstore staff picks and blurbs. Supposedly, the first blurb was written by Ralph Waldo Emerson in 1855 and published the following year on the spine of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And it said, "I greet you at the beginning of a great career." Whether or not these endorsements from celebrities or other authors do much in the way of selling books is up for debate, but publishers aren't likely to give up the practice anytime soon. There is one man who blurbs more contemporary books than just about any other, so much so it's gained him something of a reputation. So could you introduce yourself first?
Sure. I'm A.J. Jacobs, and I'm a writer and blurber.
A blurber? I've heard you referred to less politely.
All right. Well, it's a blurb whore is a phrase I've heard many times. I prefer to just, you know, I am a free love blurber. I don't think there should be a negative connotation.
How did this start? How did you get started as a promiscuous blurber, let's say?
I am a promiscuous blurber. Part of it is that I've written a couple of books in the do something for a year genre. I wrote one called The Year of Living Biblically. So then everybody who wrote a book in the same genre asked for a blurb. So, you know, I get emails, I wore clogs for a year, can you endorse my book? I played the French horn for a year, can you endorse my book?
You know, I thought there'd been some kind of intervention, AJ, that you've slowed down on this a little.
Well, that is true. I used to be a far more promiscuous blurber. But then the New York Times critic, Dwight Garner, actually tweeted, and his tweet said that half of the crap galleys he gets are endorsed by one human being, A.J. Jacobs. And so he tweeted that literally, say, at like 3 o'clock. At 3:05, both my agent and my editor were calling me and saying, we got to put a stop to this. You have a reputation. You've got to calm down and start saying no. But I still do a good amount, probably more than the average writer.
And any idea how many you've done over the years?
Over the years? Oh, that's tough. I would think I've hit triple digits.
Whoa. So, AJ, is there an art to blurbing a book? I mean, what are some of the basics of writing a great blurb?
One of my tried and trues is, and I'm not saying it's great, but it is a formula that works. You got to throw in an adverb followed by an adjective. So wildly entertaining, stunningly poignant. I've never used that, but that's an example. And then I do try to make a lame joke somehow related to the book itself. So if it's a book about religion, thou shalt buy this book. I will say that has gotten me into trouble once because unknowingly I used the same blurb twice on two different books. I repeated the same joke 2 years apart and I had totally forgotten about it. One of the books, it was about this guy who decided he wasn't going to leave any carbon footprint, just be the most environmentally friendly person ever. So I wrote, this is a great book. Buy this book, read it, and then compost it. Not bad, not bad. And then 2 years later, I get another book about a guy who's living off the grid. And I write this and send it in. And I'm like, that was pretty witty. A few days later, it occurred to me, wait a second, that kind of sounds familiar. I looked back and I'd used that same exact joke 2 years before.
You cheated on the same blurb.
And I was all nervous I was going to be busted by some snarky media website. And they would say, you can't even come up with a different blurb. And I had actually prepared my defense in case anyone busted me, which was in honor of the books. I was recycling our precious joke resources so as not to waste them. Luckily, no one ever cared enough to bust me.
Okay, so if you're a promiscuous blurber, I don't know what that makes me because I'm a promiscuous. I consume blurbs with great zeal. I can be swayed or to be more or less interested in a book depending on who blurbed it. And everyone who I work with makes fun of me for this. But do you think blurbs do make a difference when it comes to sales?
I have no idea. It is a vast mystery to me. I think if you get someone like Stephen Colbert or Jon Stewart to blurb your book, yes, that's going to make a difference. But someone, you know, just another writer, I'm not really sure it makes a huge difference. And also, as a consumer, I would recommend taking them, of course, with a grain of salt. I would say there's always something to praise about a book. So if the blurb is, you know, this is a good book, you'll be entertained, then maybe it's okay. But if the blurb is really specific and says, this is my favorite business book of the last 10 years, then that blurber really means it. And then the blurb means something. So look for the really specific, enthusiastic blurb. And those, I think, are meaningful.
AJ Jacobs, promiscuous blurber who also writes longer things like The Year of Living Biblically, The Guinea Pig Diaries, and Drop Dead Healthy. Coming up, we're going to talk to one of our own public radio colleagues about his first book. And yes, it was blurbed by AJ Jacobs. We'll get Brady Carlson's tips on how he got through his very first book tour. Fold down this page because we're coming right back with our bookish show in just a minute.
Please insert disc number 3.
Welcome back to Bookish. It's word of mouth special on writing and publishing and becoming an author. I'm Virginia Prescott. So far, we've talked about finding inspiration, avoiding distractions, and the anxiety of the author photo. Now we move on to the post-publication process.
Chapter 7. The Tour is a Harsh Mistress.
Over the past few years, we have had the privilege of watching our colleague Brady Carlson transform from public radio host to published author. We've heard about his vacation day research trips, about finding a publisher, and we all voted on his book jacket design. Brady's literary debut, which Blurb King A.J. Jacobs called the funniest and most entertaining book about death you'll read this year, is called Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. After the book was published in February, Brady embarked on a journey which few writers get to take nowadays, a national book tour.
I felt a little bit like a celebrity and a little bit like somebody who was doing a bunch of job interviews in a row.
Writing is solitary work. Selling your book is anything but. We asked Brady to share some tips for writers on how to survive a book tour.
I did a Google search, how to do a book signing, because I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never done it before. And there were three tips I found that were great. One was get a good pen. Always ask the person's name, how they would like it to be signed. You don't want to be the one guy who signs a book for Elizabeth with an S using a Z. You don't want to be that author. And think of a couple of allegedly witty things that you could write in there. Above all, don't get cocky just because you got to do a book tour. You get to be the center of attention at a book signing, and that's fun, but eventually you will end up coming back down to earth. The fewer expectations you set for yourself, the better. Some events are going to draw a lot of people. Some aren't. I've talked to 100 people at a time. I had one book event where I had 2 people. If you don't set an idea in your head of what success is at a book signing, then you won't be disappointed. I thought about having an author signature and then my regular signature because, you know, people do worry about identity theft. So you maybe don't want to have your real signature out there. But at this point, I write so few things down that I couldn't think of a new way to sign my name. So I just signed it the usual way. I mean, my signature is pretty scribbly as it is. Do a little prep work. Think about what you want to say or what part of your book you want to read. Don't just ad lib. I did think about that balance of how much of the book do I want to essentially give away in the talk, and how much do I want to save and hope that people are going to buy another copy or two. And I decided to just spill my guts. I just kind of couldn't hold back. I mean, I'd been working basically by myself on this for 4 years, and when I finally got the chance to be in front of people and talk about it, I basically couldn't stop. Bookstores are all different. I'm sure musicians have the same feeling when they go in and out of different clubs and different concert halls. I found that the bookstores that drew the most people were the sort of classic community gathering place bookstore. It can be a little bit like the living in the van thing for a musician. Less equipment, though. I think it's fun anytime you get to do something you love and you get to share it with a bunch of people and they want you to. That is really what a book signing is.
Brady Carlson is NHPR's weekend host and author of Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. Okay, book tour's over. We are moving right along on this bookish show, and there's not a whole lot more to the process, just that you hope people will read it or listen to it, which brings us to the most radio-appropriate portion of this entire show, the part where we introduce you to our award-winning narrator, Catherine Kellgren.
Chapter 8, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Audiobook.
Catherine Kellgren has narrated more than 250 audiobooks, and she's won a number of Audie Awards over the years, which are kind of like the Oscars for audiobook narrators, or maybe the Grammys, more appropriately. And she's done kids' books.
Jane, had a stuffed toy chimpanzee named Jubilee.
Historical fiction?
Kelsey woke with an aching head and a parched mouth, but it wasn't until breakfast...
Young adult and science fiction?
The space-time continuum was a chaotic system in which even a minuscule action could have...
Brandon, she has a beautiful voice and a fantastic ear for mimicry, but still it's the kind of unusual job that makes you ask, how did you end up doing this?
Well, when I was a child, I used to listen to a lot of audiobooks, and especially as a sort of teenager, I got very into listening to the old Cadman recordings of Sir John Gielgud doing Shakespeare, and to me, he was like my everything. You know, he's like my, I don't know what, Kanye West.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them.
When I got older and I studied acting, I lived in London for a long time. And when I moved back to the States, my dad was ill. He had Parkinson's disease and he couldn't read anymore. So I spent a lot of time reading to him. And in fact, when I was in London, I made my very first audiobook for him. I found a detective author that he really liked and just bought myself a handheld tape recorder and recorded the whole book for him so he could have someone read it to him. And then when I got back, I read to him a lot and I suddenly thought, wait a minute, a lot of the reason that I became interested in acting in the first place was through the spoken word, and I'd really love to do audiobooks.
Tell us a little bit about the process, how you choose books, how you're chosen for books, or how you actually do it. You read the book, you record it.
Well, the process is, if I'm lucky enough to be cast in a book, I get the book and I read it at home very slowly and thoroughly. And I'm making notes of any words I need to look up pronunciations for, any accents that I might need to work with. I have a dialect coach that when there's a particularly difficult accent or two that I work with. And then once I've done that, I go through and I highlight each different character with a different color of pen. So if you have five or six people speaking on the same page, you can do their distinct voices and really attack the text without thinking about it.
You are 28 today, Diana, and as an older woman have reduced marital prospects.
Don't be such an old crotchet, Redbreast, said Diana. I dare say someone will come along.
I use an iPad when I'm reading. I work from a paper script so that I can make all my pencil marks and use the highlighter pens, and then I scan it and create a PDF, and then I work from a great big iPad so I can blow up the page as big as possible and not have the engineer have to pause for page turns. And then usually when we're in the studio, depending upon the book, I can read around 100 pages a day, depending on the sort of text, sometimes more, sometimes less.
Sounds like a lot.
It's tiring. I mean, you need a lot of stamina for it. I mean, usually you go in about 10 in the morning, finish about 5:30 at night. And you've got a lunch break and a couple of tea breaks. But literally, I'm asking permission. Oh, can I have a sip of tea? You know, you're on all the time. And you have to pay complete attention all the time. If not, it shows in your eventual performance. So it's a tiring thing to do. But I love doing it. But it definitely requires... I'm exhausted at the end of the day when I'm done recording.
Does it help you to kind of, I don't know, form the picture of these characters in your head? How do you come up with their voicings?
Yes. I mean, again, every narrator has their different process. So I'm not the only one who highlights characters, but other narrators don't. But that is something that I do. And I do, I mean, I... First of all, we'll write down or make a note of anything the author says that describes the character physically, how old they are, if it is a book set in England or another country, what sort of social class they are. Sometimes I'll even think of actors that I love or old recordings I'll draw from. there's a wonderful actress, I'm sure you probably know her, I think she passed away in the 1970s, called Dame Edith Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a very deep voice like that. And she was known for being in the importance of being earnest and saying the line, a handbag. And I had this recording when I was a child and listened to it so many times. I practically memorized the whole play. And any time there's an old dowager with a monocle who is disapproving, it's always Edith Evans gets trotted in and I imitate her voice.
I know nothing, Lady Bracknell.
I am pleased to hear it. Ignorance is like a delicate, exotic fruit. Touch it and the bloom is gone. The whole theory of modern education is radically unsound.
But basically, I see my job as trying to get it as close to how the author would imagine it as possible. So I take my cues from them.
Talk about pacing. When you're reading, is there a sort of ideal speed that you're going for?
I think the text itself dictates the speed at which you read. And part of what's important about narrating for me is trying to pick up on the dynamic the author has set in the book. And the book will dictate how expressive you are. It's one of the reasons I love doing children's books. The characters are much bigger. You get to ham act a lot more when you get to be a talking cat or, a dragon. And there's certain books that I have habits. For instance, I just recorded a biography of the singer, quote-unquote singer, Florence Foster Jenkins.
The terrible singer.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Famed for being absolutely abysmal. And, for instance, when I was recording that book in the morning to keep our spirits up and give us inspiration, me and the engineer would listen to her recordings just to kind of remind us what we were dealing with. They are inspirational, her recordings, I have to say. So it just depends on the book, but I do develop little tics and habits.
So now we have more and more books being published each year, and I would think there'd also be an increase in the number of audiobook narrators. What does the competition look like in the business?
Well, the wonderful thing about the industry is that it's growing exponentially. And I think there is room for all sorts of different narration, narrators. Lately, it seems to have exploded. And there has been a kind of move towards people with home studios. But publishers are still willing to spend the money to hire a studio and hire even a director for audiobooks. But it's changed a lot in the almost 10 years or so that I've been recording audiobooks. It used to be that every book that you did had a director, almost everyone. And now it's very rare.
What does a director add to the process?
A director just kind of would rein you in, help you if you are, your pacing seems to be a bit off, or you've slipped out of a voice. Also, it's a sort of terrifying business in a way, being alone in a booth with the responsibility of recording a book, because here is something that an author has poured years of love and attention into, and you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants in a sense. I'll do as much research as I possibly can, but then once you're in the studio, you just have to let go. But I find it an enormous help to have another set of ears besides the engineers.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine, for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Catherine Kellgren, the award-winning narrator of more than 250 audiobooks and our guest narrator for this episode, which is just about done. I'm Virginia Prescott, really hoping you enjoyed all things bookish, and thank you for joining us. We encourage you to read loads, read often over the summer. And now, on to the essential final chapter, in which we expose how shows about how books get made get made. Catherine?
Chapter 9, A Farewell to All. Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon, Jimmy Gutierrez, Taylor Quimby, and Maureen McMurray. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The end.